Is corporate ethics an oxymoron? Do you have to be a jerk to be a successful CEO? Is exploitation the only path to profit? The good news is that many companies, big and small, in the food economy are blazing a different path through Wall Street's jungle of greed, demonstrating that money and morality can be compatible. Texas supermarket chain HEB, for example, has drawn an intense loyal customer base by 1. Investing in good wages and benefits for employees, 2. Showing up in such emergencies as pandemics, hurricanes, freezes to give essential supplies and hands-on help, and 3. Being an involved and supportive neighbor to the hundreds of unique communities it serves. Also, Maine Grains is relocalizing the business of milling grain by working with local farmers who had been abandoned by global grain marketers. They're producing flours from heritage grains, boosting the local economy in the process. Then there's Bob's Red Mill, which also mills its products from diverse natural grains, and it's 100% employee-owned. These are part of a rising business alternative to the selfish profiteering ethic of Fortune 500 titans. Called certified B corporations, they definitely exist to make a profit, but they're equally focused on having a positive social impact, prioritizing fair wages, environmental protections, and healthy communities as core elements of their missions, even making those goals legal requirements of their corporate charter. This is Jim Hightower saying Ben & Jerry's and New Belgium Brewery are just a couple more of some 3,800 other businesses now organized as B Corps. Though not pretending to be perfect, they're at least striving to be more than money grubbers, instead trying to contribute to the common good. For more information, go to bcorporation.net. The Hightower Radio Lowdown is made possible by you lowdowners who subscribe to our monthly newsletter, The Hightower Lowdown. You know who you are. Thank you.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So big news today, the horse that won the Kentucky Derby, they had some drug problems maybe, evidently going to be able to race in the Preakness Stakes coming up this weekend, and from what I'm reading, this is the first time they've let a horse that has had drug problems run in another race. And this part of me goes, I kind of get the fairness. The drug test was wrong, you get to do this, but what if it wasn't? And he wins another one. That's going to be interesting. But here to share some thoughts on, the Medina Spirit horse, the race, our horse racing expert, asked our good friend Travis Waldron to come back and talk with us. He's a reporter over at Huffington Post. He covers politics and sports in Brazil and across the U.S. And is in Kentucky where the Derby actually happened. You may remember our conversation about the valets who may have gone on strike. Travis, thanks for taking time for us.
Of course.
So let's start with the strike. Didn't happen. I was kind of surprised. Didn't happen.
It didn't happen. I wouldn't say I'm completely surprised that it didn't happen. I mentioned, I think when I was on the show that the valets at Churchill and other tracks, they also, a lot of their compensation comes from agreements, commission-based agreements with jockeys and trainers. And so the Derby Day is obviously a big money day for them in that front too. So, at the very least, it seems they got an agreement to keep talking and negotiating about the contract on better terms than what they thought they had before the race. Well, so
I wish them the best, and I hope they get a good contract and they get what they deserve. Let's talk about this Medina Spirit horse, 12 to 1 odds. I wish I'd have put money down.
But I had him in my bet, but I didn't have the other horses.
Oh, so you can't just pick the winner. You got to pick other ones too.
Well, you can, but I tried to pick the top two, right. And I picked number one and number three, but not number two, which you don't get anything for that.
Yeah, you get nothing for that. But the horse won and has some drug issues. What are the drug issues? What for those of us who don't know much about horse racing, what is the issue?
So it was a drug that was a corticosteroid. So not like an anabolic performance enhancing steroid, but more like an anti-inflammatory, I guess. I'm not a pharmacist or a drug expert, so I'm not exactly sure what the drug itself was, but or even how to pronounce it necessarily.
Right.
But now Bob Baffert, the trainer, is claiming that it came from a dermatitis treatment. This is like his third set of claims for
right.
what it came from. So, you know, who knows? And as several horse racing journalists have written this week, this is not the first time Bob Baffert has had these sorts of questions around his horses, and not the first time that a lot of these questions have been raised about horse racing, although it is pretty much the biggest one ever at the Kentucky Derby, at least in recent times. And the test is still outstanding, I guess. They're testing a split sample. So even though he's running in the Preakness this week, it's still possible that his Derby win gets invalidated, which is a bummer for the horse because he didn't have anything to do with
yeah.
it.
Yeah, well, I don't think the horse knows either way.
Right.
What about the people who placed bets and won? What if you picked the secondary winner horse and you got cheated? You got stiffed.
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't gamble enough to know the answer to that question necessarily. I assume that they would somehow pay back the people who at least had the number two horse. Cause it would be a pretty big bummer if you bet him to win and now he's the winner. We did have this, there was a controversy at the Derby a couple years ago where there was a disqualification, but that happened basically in real time. This is, you know, we're now a week later almost 2 weeks later. So it's, I don't know how they would handle it, but luckily I haven't had to worry about it because my bets all were wrong,
all
no
wrong.
Matter what they decide.
Yeah, but what happens if you won? Do they come back and try and claw back their money from you? How would they know?
I assume they don't do that. I can't imagine like how that would be logistical.
But it's just terrible. So now this horse is going to run in the next race. Has that happened before? I mean, because, you know, I was sitting here thinking about, you know, all the talk about cancel culture, and because this Baffert guy did a really great job of going out there and using that frame. They've used it so much that they influenced the board of this race to go, oh, yeah, we'll make an exception this one time in like a gazillion years just for you because you used the word cancel culture.
Right. It's amazing that cancel culture is now just, you know, and it always has been at this point, like whatever you want it to be, against any sort of criticism whatsoever. I'm not positive that it doesn't seem like there's ever been a case like this. I'm not sure there has ever been a case to even sort of test it on this level. You know, like I mentioned, there was a disqualification in the Derby a few years ago, but that had to do with an on-track infraction, not a random drug test. And so, you know, I don't know that the people running the Preakness have ever had to deal with something like this coming out of the Derby, at least not that I think there was one Derby horse disqualified for a drug test back in the 60s, maybe, but it hasn't happened anytime recently. And so it's kind of an unprecedented, weird situation. And then you throw on that horse racing is regulated by the states. So Kentucky and Churchill Downs and Maryland and Pimlico kind of all have their own jurisdictions and get to set their own rules and decide what they want to do. So there's not like one big national governing body that says, oh, you messed up in Kentucky, so now you can't run in Maryland.
Right. I can see that. Maybe there should be. We'll see. We'll see how this plays out. Any chance the horses can actually win? Because it's now, I guess, a 9-5 favorite. Is that what I'm reading?
Yeah, I mean, I think other than last year, Baffert's undefeated when he takes a Derby winner to the Preakness, which last year they ran him out of order, so it doesn't really count. But, you know, I wouldn't bet against him, but I'm probably not going to bet it because I – you know, threw away my money last weekend.
Yeah, I haven't gambled in probably 30 years because I hate losing, and
yeah,
it is what it is. I did want to change topics. We'll see how the race turns out. Move over to another race, the race to get DC statehood. You're part of a team that's come out with an article. There's never been a good argument against DC statehood. Why has it taken so long to get statehood for DC? I mean, this is something that, you know, 30 years ago, I remember people, you know, arguing for.
I mean, the shortest answer is the most obvious one, which is that it's racism. you know, DC for most of its history has been a majority black population. It's currently right under a majority black population and still majority minority. It's, I think, about 46% black and I think 11 to 12% Hispanic and Latino. So, I mean, I think that's it's part and parcel with the disenfranchisement of black people that has gone on through the entire history of this country. The longer answer is that, and if you talk to the activists here, they'll say that, you know, not enough Americans and not enough lawmakers have ever cared about the plight of D.C. or even really been aware of the plight of D.C. and what a lack of statehood means. You know, that there's this perception of Washington, D.C., that it's just the swamp, to borrow a phrase from our 45th president, and that it's full of corrupt politicians and nothing else. And it erases the fact that there are 700,000 people who live here, that those people are not all and not even nearly all politicians or even working in politics. You know, it's just like any other city or town or state in the rest of the country. But, you know, in the past, there hasn't been the political will to get it across the finish line. The last time they fully voted on statehood in the House before the last 2 years was 1993, and it didn't even pass in the House. And I'm sure a lot of your listeners remember 2009 when there was a fight for congressional vote just to give DC a congressional vote, not statehood. And it passed in the Senate, but failed in the House because the Republicans attached a amendment that would have basically overridden DC's gun restrictions. And so the thing here is that, again, it's a mix of the same sort of disenfranchisement of black and brown people that this country has been a part of this country's history since its founding. And also the fact that, you know, people just, I don't think even realize that DC is a city where real people live and that statehood causes a whole lot of problems and a whole lot of disenfranchisement and, you know, really a total absence of democracy for the people who live in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, I mean, on January 6th, you know, you had a local government that had no ability to call out the National Guard because there is no National Guard. They had to go to Maryland.
Right. And, you know, there is a D.C. National Guard, but D.C. doesn't really control it. You know, a lot of times it has to be mobilized by the federal government.
Right.
And that was the case, both, you know, kind of twin cases from opposite sides of, during the racial justice protests that took place last summer and then during the insurrection. In one hand, Trump was able to mobilize the National Guard to end the military, you know, to essentially occupy the city. On the other hand, the mayor of Washington had basically no authority to mobilize the National Guard ahead of the Capitol riots when that, you know, it was obvious that there was a threat to the Capitol in that day. And that's just, you know, run down the reasons of, you know, that's a you know, recent symbolic, obvious example of how this messes up DC, but there are so many others. You know, a few years ago, we voted to legalize marijuana here and Congress basically blocked it. And so now we're in this weird gray area where marijuana is legal to possess and use, but not to sell. And all because Congress exerted an authority over the district that they cannot exert over Colorado or California or Washington or anywhere else.
So you can give it away, but you can't sell it.
You can give it away, but you can't sell it. So okay. We have it was basically a loophole in the way that the Home Rule Act and everything works, that allowed for a partial implementation of the law, but not full regulatory atmosphere to be, regulatory regime to be set up to allow for legal dispensaries and other methods of selling.
Right. Now, obviously this is a political issue because if DC were to be a state, you'd get two more Democratic senators. I don't see there being any way a Republican wins in DC on the short term or even the long term. So, you know, obviously the Republican voters are going to say, no, we can't possibly do this because this is all it's really about. And some of that's true from the outside. You know, as I look into it, I go, look, they should have representation and two additional senators would not be a bad thing.
Yeah. It, you know, look, it's a fact of the matter that if Washington, D.C. gets two senators and congressional representation, there are going to be three more Democrats in the Capitol from Washington, D.C. Like, this city voted 95-5 in the last presidential election, and that wasn't because it was Donald Trump. And, like, it was similar numbers when it was Obama versus Romney. It was similar numbers when it was Clinton versus Bush, and or Clinton versus Dole and Bush versus Gore, and so on and so on. But, you know, for one, the Constitution doesn't say you don't get to be a state if you vote for a different party than someone else would prefer. Two, it's just as partisan for Republicans to oppose DC statehood because it would produce two more Democratic senators as it is for Democrats to support it because it would produce two more Democratic senators. And three, and the main reason, is that the residents of Washington, D.C. are not pushing this because they want two Democratic senators. The people behind statehood, the statehood movement in D.C. is based on the fact that they want representation in Congress and they want the right to govern themselves.
So let me ask you this. You know, wouldn't the simple solution be, you know, just add them to Maryland or Virginia, or, you know, just add them somewhere? Okay, you're part of this state now. You're just a city. You're Washington, D.C. in the city in the state of Maryland or Virginia. Couldn't you do that?
So retrocession to Maryland is a newly popular idea on the right. You have people like FreedomWorks pushing it, and then Mitt Romney, Susan Collins, a lot of lawmakers in the House are pushing it. But the thing is retrocession doesn't really solve the problem. In fact, it's a perfect example of the problem, which is that DC wants the right to choose its own representation, and retrocession is a solution that would be forced on DC. DC and Maryland touch each other, but they're very distinct, different places. DC hasn't been a part of Maryland for more than 200 years. If you go down the list of states, including Mitt Romney's, including Susan Collins, those weren't states. Those were part of other states the last time DC, or in the case of Utah, didn't even remotely exist. Florida, for instance, as we wrote in the story, was part of Spain the last time DC was a part of Maryland.
Can we give Florida back to Spain?
Yeah, look, that's a conversation for a different day. But, you know, when it comes down to it, that neither Maryland nor D.C. supports retrocession of D.C. to Maryland. It would completely change the politics of Maryland. It would completely, you know, basically fold Washington, D.C. into a state with which it doesn't identify and isn't a part of and hasn't been a part of at any point anywhere near anyone who's alive's life. And the people of D.C. have voted. They have spoken. They want statehood. They prefer statehood. And, you know, as far as I can tell, like we put in the headline right there, there's not, when you really go down through it, there's not really a good argument against it. People cite retrocession. They cite various parts of the Constitution, but none of it really addresses the fact or answers the question of why don't the people of Washington, D.C. deserve the sort of representation that they have said they want?
Because that's why. Because I said so.
That's essentially what it boils down to.
Yeah, because I said so. So how do you go about doing this? Do we need a constitutional amendment? You said Congress has to vote. How would this work? How would it happen? Because it's not just D.C. There are people talking about statehood for Puerto Rico and other territories. How does this game work?
So with regard to H.R. 51, the law that's in the legislation that passed the House each of the last two sessions, there's a belief among advocates for statehood in D.C. and in Congress, obviously, that this can be done through simple legislation. That's the way that I believe all 37 new states were added to the Union. There's an argument that D.C. requires a constitutional amendment because the Constitution requires a federal district, but H.R. 51 specifically carves out I think it's about 2 square miles around the Capitol, the National Mall, and the White House to remain the federal district, and just makes the residential areas of D.C. the new state. The Eleanor Holmes Norton, who is the D.C. non-voting delegate to Congress, argues that that's perfectly enough to satisfy the constitutional requirement. It's a little bit different than Puerto Rico and other territories, just because While there are, especially with regards to Puerto Rico statehood movements, there are more complicated questions about colonialism and potential independence there. Whereas with DC, like we've had referendums twice, overwhelmingly have voted for statehood. And so, you know, really it, there's no question where the District of Columbia stands on statehood. The city council, the mayor, the non-vote, the delegate to Congress, and the population are all united behind the idea that they want statehood.
And, yeah, I mean, and so they are surrounded by states. It would be nice if they were one.
Right, exactly. And you know, it would be nice to have your own representatives in Congress and your own government.
People you can yell at and scream at. I'm right there with them. Sadly, I don't think it's going to happen. But, you know, well, so I guess last question I've got, because, you know, if we have to go to the if this legislative route is the way to go, is this something that can be done with through budget reconciliation? Because it is never getting 60 votes.
I don't think it can be done through reconciliation, but the main group pushing statehood, or one of the main coalitions pushing statehood in D.C. right now, is called 51 for 51, which, as their name suggests, they want it to be able to be done with 51 votes, a simple majority in the Senate. And what they advocate for is a kind of smaller filibuster reform, not a whole scale abolition of the filibuster, but a filibuster change or rules change that means that a statehood bill could go through with a simple majority of the Senate.
Yeah.
Again,
here's my
that
problem
seems
with
pretty
that.
Unlikely.
Here's my problem with that. The second you crack that door open, it's going to give the Republicans the reason to kick it completely off the hinges. So if you're going to crack the door open, just kick it off the hinges.
Yeah, I mean, I think I don't know that the people behind 51 for 51 are necessarily opposed to a full-scale abolition of the filibuster, but they, with regards to the movement itself, they leave it, you know, just a statehood bill should be able to move through here, because other states have been created out of simple majorities. And again, if you go down, other states have been created through legislation. Other states, even if you take the argument that it is only about Democratic senators, many other states were created for purely partisan reasons. And, you know, so there's, as far as I can tell, again, like, I'm hardly an unbiased source here. I live in D.C. I think statehood is good, because I think people deserve representation in democracy. But even setting those aside, if you look at the arguments against it, I just don't think any of them hold water, except unless your position is, I don't want statehood.
Or because I said so. If you've got a thought on it, I'd love to hear it. If there's a good reason out there why D.C. shouldn't be a state, I want to hear it. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. You can also check out Travis's article over at Huffington Post. There's never been a good argument against D.C. statehood. We'll get links out on social media on how you can take a look at that. Travis, I appreciate your time. Always great talking with you. Keep up the great work, man.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Anytime, our good friend Travis Waldron. Again, check out that piece. We'll make sure we get links out. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1967. That was the day United Farm Workers Sons of Zapata joined with the Confederation of Mexican Workers in establishing an international picket line across the Rio Grande Valley. A push to organize farm workers at six major growers began the year before in the spring of 1966. Wages in Starr County ranged from 40 to 85 cents an hour. Farm workers began their strike in June of 1966 for wage increases and union recognition. But growers would rather see their crops rot than recognize the union. They did grant wage increases, but immediately ran to the courts for injunctions. One district judge outlawed all picketing, while police instructed county workers to spray the strikers with insecticide. That August, workers voted to organize with the United Farm Workers and began a pilgrimage march to the state capitol to popularize their cause. 15,000 workers and their supporters reached Austin on Labor Day to demand their right to organize. They returned to Stark County to continue their strike. The growers turned to Mexican commuters holding green cards to break the strike. The United Farm Workers began picketing at Roma and Rio Grande City bridges and were often successful in turning back green card workers. By May 1967, melon harvest had begun. After months of negotiations, picket lines went up on both sides of the international bridges. The picketing was 100% successful for 2 days. But the Mexican government and Starr County Sheriff's Department soon intervened to break up the picket lines. Texas Rangers were brought in to arrest and brutalize strikers. The strike was broken, but organizing continued throughout the region. Picketing across borders was itself an important act of international solidarity. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So some good news on the National Rifle Association, the NRA. You may remember they tried to declare bankruptcy. Even though they had millions of dollars in the bank, they tried to declare bankruptcy because they were about to be sued in a pretty big way. And in fact, you know, they were chartered in the state of New York from like 1871. So just recently they're like, no, we're going to Texas, you know, because Texas has better laws to get away from, being sued. So I guess what happened was the judge said, no, you're not going to be able to game the system. You filed this suit in bad faith. They said the petition was not filed in good faith, but rather an effort to gain unfair litigation advantage against the New York Attorney General, Letita James, because there's a civil suit there. I'm glad to see this. This is going to be one of those moments where you're going to have to pay up. Dig deep. You're not going to have the money to maybe ask Vlad to send over some money from Russia, something, get Maria Bettina back out there, peddling some guns. But you're going to get sued. Moving to Texas or not. As I was reading this, I'm going, but this is what the rich in corporate America have been getting away with forever. They run things into the ground. They file bankruptcy and they, oh, sorry, oops. And they stick the little guy with all the leftovers, with all of the external costs, with all of the pollution, with all the degradation, with all the fallout. And I'm glad that the court said, nope, no one's above the law. Good for that judge. Also, some good news today. Vineyard Wind, new project there off of Martha's Vineyard. This is something that they've been talking about for a while. The go-ahead was approved today. They're talking about 62 turbines of wind power off the coast of Martha's Vineyard. They say it's going to produce enough electricity for 400,000 homes. It's going to create, they say, about 3,600 jobs. This will be done, I guess, some part by 2030. We're going to be moving away from the fossil fuels and towards the renewable energy, which is something we need to be doing. Look, if this Colonial Pipeline thing showed us anything, our infrastructure really vulnerable. And, I go back to the year 2000 when everyone thought the world was going to end because of Y2K. Did we learn nothing from that moment? Literally, everyone thought because we were so dependent on computers, so dependent on all of the things, being computerized, that we had no idea what was going to happen. And you would have thought back then we would have tried to decentralize a little bit, but I'll tell you, this is one of those moments where if I'm Biden, I'm out there often talking about this is why we need massive infrastructure spending. This is why we need to be energy independent. We need to stop drill baby drilling. We need to stop being dependent on foreign countries for other things. We're in a state of economic warfare. Just my thought. Love to hear yours. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, Matthew Chapman, reporter over at Raw Story, is going to be here to share some of his top stories of the day. Quick break. Right back with Matt.
waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Colonial Pipeline delivers nearly half of all the diesel and gasoline to the East Coast, and it's delivering it to the Northeast, which is the least energy independent part of the entire country.
America's largest pipeline system shut down by major cyber attack. Air pollution from farms kills thousands of Americans every year, new study finds. Ominous warnings of deepening drought in California. Plus, Biden moves to restore landmark protection for birds.
All of those stories for the birds and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
People like Lindsey Graham, this is him a few days ago, "I've come to conclude that climate change is real." Well, welcome to 1990, yeah. Lindsey.
This is your Green News Report.
Pull up a beanbag chair.
Okay, Desi Doyen, when I saw this cyber attack on the Colonial Pipeline, I was trying to think, what did we cover them recently? And in fact, they were the company that had a pipeline spill in the North Carolina Nature Preserve. They said last year it was 63,000 gallons. Turns out this year we learned it was more than 1 million gallons. Well, I guess Colonial Pipeline is back in the news again today.
Yes, sadly, they are. The Colonial Pipeline system, the largest in the nation that delivers 45% of fossil fuel supplies to the East Coast, was shut down over the weekend by what appears to be the largest ever ransomware attack on U.S. energy infrastructure to date.
Well, I guess somebody has finally figured out how to shut down Colonial Pipeline.
The FBI identified a known foreign criminal ransomware gang as responsible. The pipeline company says the cyber attack hit only IT networks, not operations. As we go to air, it's unclear when full operation will be restored, but the company says it is restarting it in stages.
Well, if the company says something, I guess we ought to believe them. Am I right?
The Biden administration is assisting the company and issued a regional emergency declaration to ensure distribution of fuel supplies. Experts say, depending on the shutdown's duration, there may be price spikes and shortages in some regions. The incident highlights the huge vulnerabilities of the nation's aging infrastructure. According to cybersecurity expert Rob Lee on CNN, it won't be the last cyber attack on U.S. infrastructure.
All of our industries are going through some level of a digital transformation, which means they're becoming more and more connected. Everybody is vulnerable. We are going to experience attacks. The real question is, how can we be more responsive and more resilient in the face of those attacks so that the consequence doesn't impact our daily lives?
Now, President Biden's American Jobs Plan has an answer for that. It includes funding to harden U.S. infrastructure cybersecurity overall. But from a risk management perspective, reliance on a single company for half of the East Coast's fuel supply is suboptimal.
Yes. And by the way, doing anything about this would be against the Republican rule that infrastructure is only things, you know, made of concrete, like roads and bridges, I guess, right?
Yep. There's that, too. In other news, air pollution from farms kills nearly 18,000 Americans every year.
Oh, great.
That's according to a first-of-its-kind study of emissions from hog farms in North Carolina that examined residents' complaints of respiratory and heart ailments from noxious fumes emanating from the expansion of massive hog farms and manure waste lagoons after the North Carolina legislature weakened regulations. In one North Carolina county, the study linked 89 premature deaths directly to emissions caused by the nearby hog farms.
Wow.
Nationally, the researchers estimate almost 18,000 premature deaths across the United States could be attributed to farm air pollution, and they pinpoint meat production as the leading source.
Mm, I guess Biden's going to have to ban beef again.
In California, ominous signs of deepening drought. Water stored in the state's mountain snowpack is essentially gone, down to just 8% of average for this time of year. Early season heat waves caused the rapid snow melt, which has led to an unusually early spate of critical fire weather conditions with record dry vegetation for the month of May. But some good news.
Thank you.
Electric cars, vans, and SUVs will be cheaper for car makers to produce than fossil fuel vehicles by 2027. That's according to a new forecast from Bloomberg New Energy Finance, which projects that larger vehicles like SUVs will be as cheap to produce as conventional gas and diesel vehicles by 2026 and smaller cars by 2027.
Nice.
Bloomberg attributes this fast inflection point to the rapidly falling costs of manufacturing batteries, as well as car makers ramping up production lines dedicated solely to electric vehicles.
So they'll be the same price, hopefully, as a internal combustion car, and yet you'll never have to pay for gas ever again.
Exactly. Finally, great news for birds. The Biden administration has finally begun the process of revoking a Trump administration rule change that gutted the Migratory Bird Treaty Act that would have allowed industry and individuals to kill unlimited birds as long as they claimed it was unintentional. The Biden administration has proposed new rules to replace the old Trump rules.
And presumably, they're better rules.
Yes.
For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
New book out by the Pulitzer Prize-winning Washington Post reporter Carol Leoning. Evidently, the claim is that the Trump family in deep with the Secret Service agents. And it's one of these kind of things where you're going, maybe leave the Secret Service agents alone. I guess this is bad. But evidently they were servicing the agents. I guess that's the way it's being spun because Donald Trump Jr.'s wife evidently is dating the former Secret Service agent that used to protect them. So you know this was part of the thing going on the whole time. And they went through, I guess her book is kind of like the whole family took a turn at one point or another. So there you go. The scandals never end. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on the top stories of the day, maybe even a little bit about the, as the Trump turns, I've asked our good friend Matthew Chapman to come talk with us. Matthew is a reporter over at Raw Story, where he does fantastic work, rawstory.com, the website. Matthew, thanks for taking time for us.
Great to be back, Rick.
So what do you think of this salacious, just coincidence that all these Trump women are finding Secret Service agents to go running off with?
I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't doubt this story for a second. It just seems very on brand for the Trump family.
Let's go to something my Republican voters will really be thrilled with. And they'll be really happy with. Vladimir Putin scored 8 goals, leading his team to a 13-9 victory in the game that Vlad plays every year.
Absolutely. He absolutely crushed it out there. He was moving around that puck so much it looked like the other team wasn't even trying to beat him.
Is it one of those situations where if you see him up against the boards, you just don't? Or if you do take that shot, you cross-check him into the boards, do you end up in a gulag somewhere?
I don't know. You know, I think the best encapsulation of this whole thing was a couple years ago when he did the same thing, scored a ton of goals, and then on the victory lap he face planted on the ice
and then he melted the ice just for spite.
Well, you'd think he could melt ice by glaring at it.
Yeah. There is that. It was one of those things I always thought that Trump would try at one point. You know, some kind of spectacle that, you know, people would let him, you know. I mean, golf isn't one of those things that, you know, people are going to really watch and score as much, you know, especially since I'm sure he does a lot of kicking out of the woods. But, you know, I always thought he would do something and make himself look like Kim Jong-il used to, you know, say he bowled, you know, the only time he went bowling, he had a 300 game. He played golf at 18 holes and won. You know, that kind of legend stuff. I was kind of expecting that out of the former guy.
Well, you know, strong men, or in the case of Trump, I guess you could call him aspiring strong men. You know, they have a lot of different ways of projecting their strength. I mean, I think Trump was just happy with with the sort of photo ops he did, you know, holding that Bible upside down outside a church, dragging the troops out to pose with them whenever he wanted. You know, there's all sorts of different ways of doing it.
Good point. I want to get your thoughts on Liz Cheney. She says she's not going down without a fight. She's out there giving it her all. And I care even less than I did yesterday, which was none. And cared even less yesterday than I did before, which was none. But I'm curious your thoughts.
Well, you know, I think we can all agree that Cheney is not really in step with, you know, with progressive values for certain. But, you know, what does seem to be obvious is that she isn't comfortable promoting a lie that would just completely undermine the foundations of democracy. In that sense, I guess we can applaud her. You know, I think that Republicans are not going to get what they're hoping for out of this. You know, they, you know, whenever they purge people, there'll always be a new set of people who are just disloyal enough to purge. And, you know, one day they're going to wake up and find they purged everyone but like the very hardcore.
Yeah, but you know, they're the party of they're the Big Ten party, they said. Which I when I heard that, I'm going, since when? When has that party been the homogenous party of white old guys? When's that been a Big Tent party?
Well, you know, to be fair, you do need a pretty big tent to have. I was that kind of circus.
Yeah, you know, but you know, here's the thing. They're the party of Donald Trump. They're the party of Marjorie Taylor Greene. They're the party of Lauren Boebert. They're the party of, you know, the guy who's having sex with underage girls and paying them on, you know, Venmo or whatever it is. That's who they are now.
It is. And they're every day being more and more like a personality cult to the problem. And that's where Liz Cheney had to get off. I mean, she's a hardcore conservative, but you know, she's interested in the weeds of the stuff. She's interested in advancing conservative policy. She didn't sign up to kiss the ring of a tyrant.
And here's the thing, and this is the part that puts me in this weird spot, because I do respect the fact that she's willing to stand up to them and say, no, I'm not going to lie for you. No, you know, the former guy didn't win. There aren't Chinese ballots. There are no ballots from Mars. None of this conspiracy nonsense happened. Stop it. I do respect that. But I think her ideas and her policies have been horrible for this country. And anything she would come up in the future, I think, is just as bad. So I have bad on this side, and then I got horrible, you know, people who want to destroy the Capitol and defecate on the floor and urinate on desks. I got them on the other side. So, you know, for me, there's really nothing left in the Republican Party to salvage.
I think you're right. I think that, honestly, the fact is that I hope that sometime in the future there will be a massive realigning election that changes the Republican Party into something that is, you know, workable within the framework of democracy. And, you know, the optimist in me says that history shows these realignments do happen. But, you know, for the time being, this party has just proven itself to be a horrendous danger to all of the institutions that we hold dear.
Yeah. Now, the person who's going to replace her, this Elise Stefanik, what's the MO on her?
Well, you know, it's a really funny thing. So at the time that she won her seat, it was kind of a swingy district. And in some ways it still is. It actually did it did swing back towards Biden in 2020. But you know, the thing is, she started out running as a moderate. She was endorsed by Romney and stuff. Although, to be fair, that was back in the era when Romney wasn't really considered a moderate. But the thing is that she realized that to advance her career, she needed to be more of a personality cultist. So that's what she did. And the change really, you could really start seeing it during the first impeachment. That's when she really started taking the spotlight, became a national name, and grandstanded in Trump's favor.
No, I mean, and that seems to be what you've got more than anything. you know, you got these new Republicans who have come in. They're not ideological as much as they're basically reality TV stars who are looking for their niche to get famous so they can cash in. I mean, I look at the one from Colorado with the gun stuff. Immediately, she came in with really slick videos and really well done image kind of stuff that, you know, really stuck her ground as she's the gun chick, man. She's gun Nazi Barbie. And she's not going away from it at all. And, you know, that's her niche. And it seems like you've got these people that's what they're trying to do more than actually legislate or represent their voters. It's about making their image.
Absolutely. I mean, and you mentioned Marjorie Taylor Greene, too. I mean, ever since she was stripped of her committee assignments, she's been languishing in total irrelevance in terms of policymaking. And basically, the only way that she's ever relevant from a congressional day-to-day stance is that she takes these random votes to adjourn the House just for the hell of it. And it annoys even Republicans.
But here's the thing, and I'll be honest, I've been saying it for the longest time. I was against having her kicked off the Labor and Education Committees. I don't think Democrats should have been doing anything to help Republicans out of their nightmare. I want her on the Education Committee. So every time I go, we need more education funding, I look at her and go, see, this is why. We need more education funding. As my son always said, she's not worthless. She serves as a bad example.
That's certainly not a bad image. I mean, I would argue that stripping of her committee assignments hasn't really shut her up as much as many people were afraid of. But I definitely see your point.
No, what's it? There's a quote. I used it yesterday. It's attributed to Sun Tzu that when your enemy's, you know, going down, you know, let them, you know, get out of the way when they're destroying themselves. You know, let them, you know, get out of the way. Let them go. You know, give them some more rope. Good luck. You know, try and save them.
Exactly. And, you know, that's, and, you know, there's a story just tonight about a bunch of former Republican staffers led by Miles Taylor who are threatening to form their own third conservative party if the Republicans don't make changes.
Good.
You know, that's the sort of thing we should stand back and let happen.
I'm in favor of it. Good. You go. I'm encouraging it. I want Liz Cheney to start a party. Let her and Mitt Romney start one.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, obviously, I could never see her switching parties, but I could definitely see her becoming a you know, conservative independent the way Justin Amash was.
Yeah. No, I mean, we had Joe Walsh on the program last night, former Tea Party guy from Illinois. And, you know, he's saying,
I know him. I'm good friends with him.
Yeah. You know, he's saying, look, I don't have a home. I've got nowhere to go. He goes, I'm not a Democrat. That's never going to happen. And I'm no longer this. And I'm going, well, start a party. You know, grab Liz Cheney, grab Mitt Romney, grab a couple of them, Kinzinger from Illinois, start your own party. Met with silence. but, you know, because
I don't have much to add to that.
No, because, you know, at the end of it, you know, the weird thing for me, though, Matthew, is that the Republican Party is who they are. I mean, you know, they may look crazy with the Marjorie Taylor Greens and the Boberts and the Gates. They may look crazy on the national level. But when you start looking down to the local level, I'm looking here where I live in Pennsylvania at the choices for the Republicans to pull out for governor, someone like Doug Mastriano. And I'm going, crazy white Christian nationalist. Really? Is this who we want running for governor in 2022? These extremists who are the ones who are, you know, stopping the steal and we're going to storm the Capitol and having these, you know, basic, you know, these idiotic protests during the heart of a pandemic because they didn't want to wear a mask. These are the people who are running for state government. These are the people who are running for city council. These are the people who are running for your freaking school boards. The people who are saying during a pandemic, no, send all the kids into school. Nuts.
You know, the irony is you would think as a very gerrymandered state, at least at the legislative level still, Pennsylvania would have a big bench of Republicans to pick from. But, you know, that might also be part of the problem because, you know, with the gerrymandering, they don't really have to hold themselves accountable to voters because they pick their own voters.
No, but here's the thing, and this is where I think a lot of people haven't really figured out what's going on with the Republican Party because, you know, I believe Republican voters – I do believe there are some Republican voters who do want some bipartisanship. They do want good things. I think what's happened with the Republican Party over the last 20 years is they keep marching further to the right. The moneyed interests keep moving them further and further to the extreme. You got talk radio who fuels this extremism. You've got Fox News who fuels this kind of, you're never pure enough. And no matter who you are as an elected official, as a Republican, you've always got to be worrying about your right. Somebody crazier than you are is going to come out and beat you to the further extreme. And they have just marched to the end, almost to the end of the earth at this point, to where now there are people defending what happened on January 6th. There are people now calling themselves 1-6ers.
I agree. And I would argue that the gradual loss of the suburbs has really accelerated this process because, time was, the suburbs were conservative, but they were kind of a moderate type of conservative who just wanted, a sensible, pragmatic leader who would cut their taxes. And, so that was the kind of Republican who would win in a state like Colorado or Arizona. And, as those suburbs have defected to the Democratic Party, there's no real moderating force left in the primaries for Republicans. So you just get radical people who just believe insane things, and there's nothing to challenge them.
No, and look, I said
nothing
earlier,
other than the general election, obviously.
I said earlier, if 9/11 were to happen today, and it was the DNC was in one of those towers, you'd have Republicans cheering it, which is scary and freaky to me on a whole bunch of levels. But I'm in this spot where I don't doubt it.
Maybe not the leaders, but certainly a few talk radio hosts.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy times. Last story of the day. I got to get to something, a little funnier. Because, earlier I said we should give Florida back to Spain. But evidently a Florida guy, Florida man, back again. I guess he tried to use a taxi as a getaway car after robbing a bank?
Yep. That was certainly a novel choice in that it would, telegraph exactly for the sheriffs how to find him.
No, it wasn't an Uber or anything, was it? He didn't prepay for the ride.
I mean, I would say that, it certainly seems to have been like more of a conventional cab service. Yeah. I forget the name of the company.
Johnny on the Spot Taxi Service.
Yeah, that's the one.
I mean, you can't miss that one because he was right on he was right there. Now, how did they catch the guy? The cab take him home and they just roll up and grab him?
Yeah, cab took him home and they went to his home.
So for, I guess, like a little over $8,000, he's going to probably spend 25 years in jail.
Yep.
And yet you get someone like Jeff Bezos, who just is in the process of building a $500 million floating who knows what with three masts. And that's fine.
Its own mini yacht to service it. Meanwhile, you've got Amazon delivery drivers peeing in bottles.
Well, someone's got to pay that $500 million to get the yacht-sized dinghy. Crazy, crazy times, my friend. But always good stuff from you, Matthew. I appreciate the work you do over there at Raw Story. Keep it up. I look forward to talking to you again.
Will do. Can't wait to see you again.
Good stuff, Matthew Chapman. Make sure you check out his work over at Raw Story. RawStory.com is the website. We'll get links out on social media. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. Listen to The Rick Smith Show.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1894. That was the first day of the Pullman strike. The strike started in the company town of Pullman, on the south side of Chicago, where workers made luxury sleeping cars for passenger trains. As a depression swept the nation, workers had seen their wages slashed. But rents owned to the company owner George Pullman stayed the same. The strike won support from the American Railway Union and its leader, Eugene V. Debs. The American Railway Railway Union called for a boycott of all Pullman cars, and more than a quarter of a million railway workers participated in the work action against Pullman. The strike was crushed by legal injunctions and with federal troops. In a case that went all the way to the Supreme Court, Eugene V. Debs was imprisoned for his support of the boycott. One prominent supporter of the strike was Chicago area Reverend William H. Cardewine. The Reverend supported the strikers from his pulpit. After the strike, his book, The Pullman Strike, helped spread the word of Pullman. In it, he warned, "We as a nation are dividing ourselves, like ancient Rome, into two classes, the rich and the poor, the oppressor and the oppressed. On the side of the oppressor, there is power and protection, class legislation, and military support. We are following in the tracks of ancient Rome," he wrote, "instead of learning lessons from her failures and defeats. No country can prosper, no government long perpetuate itself and its institutions, which does not administer judgment and justice alike to all its people." These words from Reverend Cardewine seem more relevant than ever today. Will we heed his warning?
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I had an interesting, you know, ad from the NRA yesterday that I tweeted out. Mother and a little girl, you know, probably, you know, 6-7 years old, with, you know, they got their AR-15s, you know, with the, you know, "Mama didn't raise a victim." And I'm going, you know, how many kids that age end up shooting themselves by accident? And is that really the image that you're putting forth? I know, you know, the NRA's, you know, their job is to sell guns, but is that the market now? 5 and 6 years old, is that it? Is that where we're heading? Very, very scary times indeed. As if we don't have enough problems with guns. You know, like I said yesterday, we had over the weekend, you had a birthday party shot up. You had, you know, a sixth grade girl going and shoot up her classroom. You've had all these stories pop up, and not even thoughts and prayers anymore. And, you know, I guess they were having a hearing today on gun violence. And I guess Ted Cruz, you know, was basically called out for being wrong, because the ideology is, you know, guns don't kill people, and we need more guns, and guns are good. And the reality is not that simple. Sane, rational policy, something that we've really, really gotten away from. And this is where this divide has worked well for the special interests. Do I like the fact that one of our political parties is crazy right now? No, it's not good for our country. It's not good for democracy. It's not good for the future. It's not good for our economy. It's not good for any of that stuff. It's not good for our politics to have wide swings and ideological views and us being so far apart. Not good, especially when you look at the fact that the rest, you know, that our enemies, I would argue China, an enemy, is moving full steam ahead to basically eat our lunch and take over and basically steal everything we've got. And we're focused somewhere completely else on idiotic fights and ridiculous issues. But it's how they've always worked it. It's how they've always kept us at each other's throats. And sadly, and I was talking about this today, I used to have Republican friends that you could have a conversation with and walk away from each other going, "Yeah, I'll talk to you tomorrow." I said, "I'll meet you in the parking lot." Those days seem to be gone. Do we get back there? I don't know. I'd love to figure it out. Anyway, if you missed any of today's program, TheRickSmithShow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast. The Rick Smith Show app on the smartphone. Take the program on the go wherever you go. And as always, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Thanks so much for tuning in. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. email Rick. Email Rick at rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.